Our life expectancy has gotten a lot longer over the last century or so. As our next guests write, a 5-year-old in 1900 could look forward to another 55 years or so. That same 5-year-old in the mid-1990s was looking at another 70-plus years.
And we're not just living longer, we're working longer, too. And that's leading to big changes in the workplace and in our personal lives. In their new book, our guests say we need to start dealing with these changes as individuals and as a society.
Rosalind Barnett is a senior scientist at the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis University, and Carol Rivers is professor of journalism at Boston University. They're the co-authors of the new book, The Age of Longevity, Reimagining Tomorrow for Our New Long Lives. Carol, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Rosalind, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, Carol, let's have you start us off with the basics. We're living longer, we're staying healthy later in life. Spell out how these changes are working.
Well, we actually have a new stage of life, which we call late adulthood, and that's roughly from 55 to 80 plus. And that was a time when, for example, the psychologist Eric Erskine said that at 65, your creative days are over and you have to sum up and face death. And what we now know is that sounds very archaic, that people who are in their 70s and 80s are, for example, running for president. Both our presidential candidates are in late adulthood. So we really have to start changing about the way we think of our lives, because we are, many of us, going to live to ages which were unthought of in the past.
And Rosalind, in the book and in pieces that have been in papers lately, you point out research that says these older workers are actually, in many ways, very good, effective, creative workers.
I know, it sounds surprising, because we our sort of cultural myth is that old workers are dotty and lazy and kind of just hang on. But in fact, they turn out to be very stable and productive. And part of the stability has to do with they have fewer ups and downs in their lives at that stage in life. They've been around the racetrack a couple of times. They're not unnerved and upended by crises. So the performance is consistent. Their cognitive skills stay fresh. So we have really very outdated ideas that we have to correct, because if we don't do that, a lot of people are going to be shortchanging themselves. If you don't have an expectation of what your life can be in your 70s and 80s, then you don't have anything to go for. So a lot of people give up and don't think that there's a future for them. But that's not the case, and our book is hopefully going to change all that.
And Carol,
it was stunning that a 2010 study found that younger workers were less stable and less consistent than the older workers. And people would have thought that it would be the reverse, but it wasn't. The older workers didn't panic if there was a problem. They knew they had many, many skills of how to get around problems and issues. They had a lot of things that the younger workers didn't offer, and that was a real stunner.
One thing that people might have reservations about is all the quickly changing technology. There's even a generation gap between, you know, millennials and Generation X on that. What did you find as you looked into this, Rosalind?
Well, for one thing, the fact that someone doesn't know a technology doesn't mean they can't learn it. So a lot of older people may not have had a need to learn some new piece of software, but that doesn't mean they can't learn it. So if you just judge someone's ability by what they're doing right now, you miss the boat. And we find that the people that we surveyed, older workers, are very savvy. They're online a lot. And they can be taught new things because they have an interest in learning them. So I think that we have to broaden our horizons a little bit and don't write people off. And it's also true that we now have a multi-generational workforce. In fact, there are 4 generations now in the workforce. And having age diversity is an important thing that will defeat ageist attitudes. And people can learn from one another. Younger workers can learn about the institutional memory that older workers have and about strategies for succeeding. And younger and older workers can learn new software and new technological skills that they might not have had a chance to learn earlier on. So you have a very rich environment for people to break through myths and to form very meaningful generational relationships.
We're talking to Carol Rivers and Rosalind Barnett. They're the authors of the new book, The Age of Longevity. We're looking at the fact that we're living longer, working longer, what that means for our society. And let's zoom out a little bit, Carol, and look at what this all means. We've got this big, huge change, it sounds like, in who is showing up at work every day. Are we ready for it? Are we thinking about what that means for what a workplace looks like, for how our society is set up?
Unfortunately, we're not, because there's so much ageism out there. And we are also thinking that there's a war, you know, that the greedy geezers are going to grab up all the resources. But what research finds is that it's really a phony war. It's like back in the days when we said when women moved into the workforce, you know, families were going to splinter, men were going to lose their jobs. And in fact, you know, as more women moved into the workforce, there were more jobs for men. And we're seeing the same thing as older workers move into the workforce, that correlates with more jobs for younger workers. And why? Probably because if you have more older workers that are on the job, you know, they're buying things, they're contributing to the economy. They're not just gobbling up resources, they're contributing. So it's a win-win for both young and old.
And Rosalind, this is sort of a virtue out of necessity, too, because as we've got a growing population of older people, the following generations, it sounds like, are smaller. We have fewer younger workers coming into the market, so we need to tap into the creativity and productivity of older workers.
That's exactly right, and I think forward-looking employers will understand that. So they really need to create a different kind of culture within their companies, a culture that's more open to having an age-diverse workforce. Another point that follows with what Carol was saying, that the typical picture we have of older workers does not include the fact that older workers are job creators, that there are many entrepreneurs that are older. We tend to think of entrepreneurs as, you know, young kids who are in their 20s and working out in their garage and dreaming of some great new thing, when in fact many more entrepreneurs are older than younger, and so they are being productive, creative members of our workforce and bringing people into the workforce in a way that we didn't imagine before.
Now, one spillover change from this idea that, hey, we're planning for longer lives than we used to. You know, a pop culture staple might have been that person in their 30s who wasn't married yet, didn't know what their career was going to be. They're running late on everything. Now, with more time to work with, it sounds like you're saying, in a way, what's the rush? Take your time. You've got a lot of stages yet to go. Carol?
It used to be that, you know, parents would say, what do you want to be when you grow up? What thing do you want to do? And now parents may ask, what two or three things do you want to do? Because typically, young people now may have two or three careers, and they may, say, at age 55, start on a completely new issue. We talked to a man who left a management job at 65 and decided to become a farmer, and is very successful at it. So we're going to see that the trajectory of people's lives is going to be different, more varied.
And Rosalind, what does that mean in terms of useful skills for younger people to have to prepare for that? Are we needing to think more about adaptability, resilience?
Well, that's probably a good question. I think people, guidance counselors and teachers and parents need to be thinking about this. Maybe of an openness, that you don't have to be locked in to think, well, you know, you've made this choice and you don't like it, tough, you know, you're stuck with it. That there's more flexibility, there are more opportunities now also for older people to go back to get education, to get retrained. Many new programs are being designed particularly for older people at low cost or no cost. So the idea that you don't have to just tough it out if you make a choice that doesn't seem to be working for you.
And Carol, you are not all optimistic about these changes. One thing you point out is that inequalities we see among people aged 0 to 65 don't magically disappear after what used to be the retirement age. Can you talk about how income disparities, racial disparities are part of this story?
Yeah, that's one of our big worries, is that we're going to have this new age. It's going to be wonderful for people who are affluent and educated and not poor, but extremely different and sad fate for people who are poor, who are not well, who haven't gotten educated. And we've just seen recently that there's been a dropping in life expectancy for particularly for blue-collar workers. And so if we don't tackle the inequality issue, then we're going to have the same problems, you know, as we grow older, that we're now seeing and we're talking about in this election cycle in the workforce. This, you know, the 1% gets and the rest does not. And that, with all this good news, that's the real problem.
We're talking about aging, quality of life, and the changing American workforce as more of us live longer and work longer.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you or is someone in your family working well past the old retirement age? And are you planning to? Are you seeing more older workers at your workplace? And how are the various generations getting along there? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about aging in America. Our guests say we're living longer, we're working longer, and we need to make some changes to reflect that new reality. Carol Rivers and Rosalind Barnett are with us. They're the authors of the new book, The Age of Longevity, Reimagining Tomorrow for Our New Long Lives.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you working past what used to be retirement age? If so, is it because you want to, you have to, or a little of both? Do you work in a multi-generational workplace? How do people from different age groups work together? And if you hire people, are you seeing more value or a different kind of value in older workers? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Jane is on the line in Racine. Jane, hi.
Hi. I'm calling because what I'm seeing is a tremendous problem with ageism. You see a lot of elders at, for example, Walmart, fast food places, who have a lot of skills, and nobody wants to hire them because they're either over 55, over 60. I have a very good friend who went for an interview, an IT job, and he had been looking, and every interview he went to, they disregarded him. And he went to a place in Madison. The job was a perfect fit, a perfect fit. And they wouldn't hire him. So until employers start recognizing all the things that your guests are talking about, you know, we're going to have a lot of very, very poor, unhappy elders out there, people who need money, but they can't get a decent job because nobody will look at them.
Jane, thanks a lot for that call. And we've done segments on this show on the difficulties faced by older people in the job market, not getting, once the employer sees their age, maybe they don't want to take a chance on an older worker. Rosalind, what's it going to change, maybe legally and culturally, to change that?
Well, one thing is the idea that you don't want to hire older workers because they're costly. You know, health costs, and it's going to go out of hand, and the company is going to be in trouble. But the new data is suggesting that's not the case, that younger workers are not cheap workers. The younger workers have young families. Young families have children, and they get sick. So the fact older workers are less expensive overall than younger workers. And that's the piece of information that would be very important to get to employers. They need to know that, because that is a roadblock. It's a mistake, and I believe, but it's there. So it's education, it's some forward-thinking CEOs who will create a program within it for their company to combat these ideas, to bring speakers in, to, you know, have a change of culture at the workplace. That's where it has to happen, because you're right, these attitudes are very subtle. Most people won't admit to them, but they're there, and it can be worked on, it can be addressed, and it needs to happen.
And Carol, I don't know if you... Go ahead.
I was saying, when we need the media to stop treating people who do something wonderful at age 78, for example, as some kind of outlier, because we're seeing more and more and more people being creative and active, and yet it is just the ageism is so hard to dent because it's so deeply ingrained. We have to keep, you know, saying it over and over and over again. Look, things have changed. It's not your granddad's world.
And Carol, in the book, you point out some people, not even in the recent era, a lot of people historically who have created their great novel or music or you name it, you know, well past age 40 or 50 or even 60.
Yes, we take a lot of people. that are creating well into what would be considered the retirement years. You look at Toni Morrison, for example, who's, I think, 85, has just written, you know, another brilliant novel. You have Ruth Bader Ginsburg in her 80s, who is, you know, one of the most outspoken and brilliant people on the court. And you see more and more and more of this. So the idea that creativity ends, you know, somewhere in the 40s, we're just seeing great many examples that that's just not true.
Let's go back to our callers. Ryan is on the line in Waukesha. Ryan, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to bring up, Ryan?
Well, I just wanted to make the point that, as previous callers have, about the difficulty of an older worker getting a job, but I've observed just the opposite, and that is getting rid of the older worker while they're still on the job. The unspoken, we want the younger person, and it's economic, and it's probably some cultural things in there too. But the pressure of older workers to leave when they're not really wanting to do that.
Ryan, thanks for that call. Yeah, we see this in the journalism industry often, Carol. If we can buy out that person older, making lots of money, and bring on a much younger person who we can pay a lot less, probably not just in journalism. Is this a common problem?
Yes, and I see, for example, in journalism, it's about the money, because I've seen really brilliant, experienced people being replaced by much younger journalists who, you know, don't know a lot in some cases and are much less sophisticated. And so I think overall the quality suffers, but it's really easy to do sort of the quick and dirty thing because it costs you less.
Talking about the new book, The Age of Longevity, the authors Carol Rivers and Rosalind Barnett are with us. We're living longer. We're working longer. We have to change some things, they say. Before we go back to our callers, Rosalind, we mentioned discrepancies by income. Are there different standards applied to men and women as we age? I think you point toward the acting profession as one where there's definitely a difference. But how about the rest of the world, Rosalind?
Well, it depends what level you're at. I think in general, women have had a harder time in a variety of occupations. At a certain level, though, you know, the stars are the stars. I mean, Toni Morrison is not going to have trouble getting her next novel published. But going down where most of us live, women have a harder time. And that's very true. Also, women tend to live longer than men. So money and how to afford a long retirement or long period of years is a huge problem. In fact, some recent data show that people are more afraid of running out of money than they are afraid of death. And this is a big problem for women. For one thing, they tend to earn less in their working lives. They also tended to take out time to rear their children, and that's cost them in the workplace in terms of seniority. So they end up with less money for retirement and very many expenses. It's all a new phenomenon now, is that the grandparents are largely responsible for the education and welfare of their grandchildren. And why is that? Because the adult children, have suffered greatly during the Great Recession. They lost their jobs, many lost their homes, they're in debt. So the grandparents often pick up the burden of the rearing the grandchildren, which adds to the other concerns that older women have. They have to support themselves and take care of themselves, but they also have this other burden they didn't have before. So I think that the women face a steeper road to climb.
Let's go back to our callers with Chris on the line in Wisconsin Dells. Chris, hi.
Good afternoon. My almost 94-year-old father was a stonemason, and a really good one. He used to split his own fieldstone, build houses from the ground up, which is a creative profession in itself. But he retired and he was bored. And so he started making these little birch reindeer Christmas decorations out of birch wood. And they're kind of hulky, but they're fun. And he does that for fun. He's working with wood, which is always a good thing. And I wanted to, he fired three artists, unfortunately. All of his children are art people. We're all underemployed. And I want to put a plug in for people going to the theater, go to the ballet, go buy some paintings for people for Christmas, or calendars that are hand-painted or something, because we are all living on the verge of society. Anyway.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Plug for Wisconsin's creative economy there. But also, she brings up a point, Roslyn, that you talk about in the book. Some people are working after normal retirement age because they have to. Some because they want to. They find fulfillment, often a little of both. Can you talk about that side of it, though, the not wanting to just be a retiree, wanting to keep doing stuff?
Well, in our culture, work is a major part of one's identity. I mean, what do you do? It becomes really important. It's a question people, and they ask the question, how are you, or what's going on? They're really talking about your work life. So if you don't have a work identity anymore, then you're really kind of a loose end, needing structure, because you know that maybe other cultures wouldn't be so much like this, but our culture is. So the absence of having colleagues, a social environment, a place to go to, goals and so forth, really hits hard. And we have a lot of years to think about filling that way. You know, it's one thing if you were 65 and you expect to live a few more years. It's another thing when you're 65 and you may live 20 more years or 25 more years. That's a long period of time. And a lot of people are searching. And I think one of the things that's coming up are these institutes for older learners. Most universities now have them. And the tuition often is either free or very low cost. So I think seniors want to have something to be engaged with, to connect with each other around something other than sitting around and gossiping. So there are things that are happening, not enough, and many people don't know about them, but certainly it's a challenge for society going forward.
We'll leave it there. Rosalind, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity.
And Carol, thanks to you as well.
I'm delighted. Thank you.
We've been talking to Roslyn Barnett and Carol Rivers. Their new book is called The Age of Longevity, Reimagining Tomorrow for Our New Long Lives, looking at the way our longer lifespans, our longer work spans are changing our lives and our society, our economy as a whole. You can still share your experiences if you are one of these people who's staying in the workforce longer. We'd love to see your story. You can share it over at the Central Time Facebook page. Are you working longer? Why? Because you have to, because you want to, or a little bit of both. Also, while you're there, we've got a link to an excerpt from their book. Again, that's all at the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it is Storytelling with a Beat on Snap Judgment. Tonight's stories from people who pushed it to the limit. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, many of us think of play as something we get to do after the lawn is mowed and the dishes are done and the hundreds of emails finally get answered.
Whether we're playing on a sports field in our backyard or over a board game, we tend to think of play as an escape from our mundane daily life, which, let's face it, can get kind of boring some of the time.
Our next guest is a game designer and philosopher, and he asks what would happen if we approached life the same way we approached games, by looking more closely at the true nature of games and applying those concepts to the daily slog. He believes we can overcome boredom and anxiety and live a more focused and meaningful life.
Ian Bogost is with us now. He's a philosopher, game designer, and professor of interactive computing, at the Georgia Institute of Technology. His new book is called Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games. Ian, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we hear sometimes about gamifying our lives, trying to take principles from games, keeping score of the things we do, that kind of thing. That's not what you're talking about, though. How are you trying to draw lessons from the world of games and play and translate them into our everyday lives?
Yeah, many people think that the unique properties of games are these ideas like points or levels. And for me, it's limitations, constraints, rules, if you want. You know, we sometimes think about the rules of a game as the things that you read, and then they guide the way that you play. And when you enter the soccer pitch, you agree to subscribe to the rules of soccer. When you play Tetris or a computer game, you kind of can't help but agree to play by the rules of the computer game. So if we take that idea of the material limitations and constraints and structure of whatever it is that we're dealing with, and then look for those limitations and constraints everywhere, then we can use that idea as a way of kind of bringing this playful way of thinking to just about anything we encounter.
Can you connect the dots for me? Why is it fun to live within a set of rules? Most of life is comprised of rules. What makes that fun?
Right. We think that we hate constraint or that we hate structure, that we're always trying to escape from it. You know, if only I could go do the thing I really wanted to, you know, and you go to work and you want to go home, and then you get home and you have, you know, chores to do, and you wait for the weekend, and then the weekend comes along and you have to mow the lawn. So in some ways, that desire for escape, that sense that real meaning is always somewhere else, it is doomed. It's hopeless. And it also assumes that there's only pleasure to be found in remarkable experiences, you know, vacations or Christmas time or birthdays or marriage or what have you. But we experience all of those repetitive things, you know, commuting to work and dealing with your email and doing the dishes and putting the kids to bed. And so it's not so much that we need to forget about the meaningful, momentous occasions, but if we can also find meaning and power in those smaller scale experiences, then wouldn't that make for a better, bigger life? But you also brought up this word fun, which is one that I address substantially in the book, and I kind of have my own, you know, my own sense of what fun means. It's one of those words that when you hear people say it, did you have fun? Oh, we had a fun time. They usually don't know what they mean at all. If you stop yourself next time you say fun and say, what am I really trying to say? It's not just pleasure exactly. It's not that, you know, I enjoyed myself precisely, because often the things that we describe as fun are kind of miserable. They involve a lot of work. You know, a fun game of soccer or even a fun outing can involve physical exertion, or it can involve, you know, working through problems with friends at the pub. So for me, fun is this discovery of novelty. And if we can find something new in anything, in any situation, even the ones that feel suffocating, by just finding their structure and seeing what we can do if we work with that material a little more directly, a little more closely, then we can, you know, we can have fun at everything.
Well, I'm a big nerd when it comes to games, board games, computer games, things like that. And I can see the sense of fun there, where in this constrained situation, I'm overcoming challenges, getting something at the end, whether I win or lose. I can see the fun in that. How do I now take that into a tedious activity, commuting, shopping at the store, something that I might not usually think of as being fun, and translate that mindset to where it is in some way fun?
Yeah, if you think of play rather than the opposite of work, you think of it as the play in a thing, like the play in a mechanism. You know, sometimes we talk about there being some play in a steering rack in a vehicle before the steering engages. Then that can be a guide. If you look at a situation or an object or a person or a scenario, you say, okay, well, you know, what's going on here? What are the structures? What are the materials that I can manipulate and use? And how might I address them and make change within them? So think about playing a guitar. When you play a guitar, you don't try to escape the fretboard and the strings and the body of it. You engage with it, right? You strum the guitar and you hold your fingers in certain patterns, and that's what playing it means. Doing something like throwing it across the room, I mean, that might be a different kind of activity, but it doesn't count as playing the guitar. So once you get accustomed to looking at the deep structure of circumstances and situations, then it's actually quite easy. What is commuting made of? Well, it's made of a set of decisions in your vehicle or on foot or in the train about which route you're going to take and when you're going to leave and which turn you're going to take here. And as you develop a series of variations, maybe on your usual routine that perhaps are chosen to find a faster route or a more scenic one, or one that you don't go by every day, or one that takes you to an errand that you have to run that day anyway. Then, you know, it's not so much that that's a game. It would be kind of ridiculous to call it a game, but rather you're playing the commuting experience, or the experience that is game-like is made out of commuting. Commuting becomes the materials by which you you play. And, you know, I think it takes quite a bit of doing to stop oneself and say, okay, you know, it's not so much that I want to play a game with my commute, but rather I want to look very deeply and closely at the structure and materials and limitations and constraints that are posed by that circumstance. And then once you do, you know, much to your delight and surprise, there's always something else you can do with it, always something new. Oh, I can load the dishwasher in this slightly different way. Or, oh, I see that, you know, doing it that way, I didn't clean the glasses on top very well, so I'm going to try something else next time. And this plays out over, you know, many, many iterations of even very ordinary, very mundane tasks. It's just that we don't find ourselves as adults so accustomed to looking at things in that way. We often lose that capacity as we grow older.
We're talking right now with Ian Bogost. He is a game designer and a philosopher, professor of interactive computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology, author of the book Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secrets of Games. And we're talking about how to bring play into all areas of our life. And Ian, you start your book taking on the commencement speech of the writer David Foster Wallace, and he's talking about some of this boring stuff about life that you were alluding to, kind of going to the grocery store and wrestling with long lines and carrying your bags and how it's kind of soul-sucking. And at the end of that essay, he says we should sort of be more empathic toward the people around us and realize that they may have tough lives too, and that's sort of how you get through that repetition and boredom of daily life. And you take issue with that. You kind of say, no, that's not any kind of way to engage with life. What do you see as being wrong with his argument?
The problem with Wallace's argument is that it puts this enormous burden on the self to come up with those alternatives. You know, so the problem that he's cueing into is that we live in this secular age. We don't look to God or to other sorts of theological or social structures to tell us the moral or the correct thing to do. It all has to come from within. And so while I think Wallace is right to ask people to stop, you know, you're always tempted to look past things, say, oh, there can't possibly be anything worthwhile in this, you know, this miserable shopping experience where I'm waiting in line behind slow people who are, you know, getting checks cleared or something. That act of stopping and saying, no, wait, there's something more here, that part's right. But the part that's too burdensome is a feeling is that we have to invent these stories about other things or other people in order to tolerate those circumstances. Because when you think about it, it's kind of like a rat race for worst case scenarios. You know, what is the most empathic possible scenario I can paint of the woman in line at the grocery store who's holding up the works, and you know, maybe she's a cancer survivor, or maybe there's a terrible thing going on at home, or maybe she had a much worse day than I do. You know, where does that end? It's much better to treat the situation for what you can prove about it, what you know about it. And, you know, it seems ridiculous to talk about having fun in line at the grocery store, but we also do it all the time. We look around. Maybe we do some email on our phone, or maybe we look at a magazine that's sitting by the rack, or review the materials in the cart, or even find ourselves aware of the temptation to purchase those items that sit at the checkout. All of those kinds of experiences, in them we're working with the world that's presented before us. Whereas, you know, inventing these stories about other people in the world, we're always doomed to think, well, you know, things could be worse. I'm still miserable because, you know, my life is still better than someone else's.
Hey, Ian, I understand your road to thinking in this way started in Milwaukee. Your father had a traffic accident that ultimately led him to have severely impaired vision. Can you talk about a little bit about your family experience and how it led to this?
That's right. I have an unusual surname, Bogost, and in fact, it was a kind of Ellis Island perversion of a much longer Russian name, and all of the Bogosts worldwide can trace their stories back to Wisconsin, where my grandfather's family settled when they came to the U.S. in the early 20th century, and my dad when he was 18. In the 50s, got in this terrible car accident and was thrown from the vehicle through the windshield and suffered. Was in a coma for a month or so. And once he came to, you know, they'd had to perform surgery. And one of the lasting effects of this that he still faces, 80 years old now, is near blindness. You know, legal blindness. He's always been visually impaired. So the whole, you know, for my whole life. Being with my dad, you know, has been a process of identifying and paying close attention to all of the ordinary things that surround us. You know, there's a step here. Don't trip over this sort of imperfection in the curb. Here's the aspirin you're looking for on the white counter that you can't quite see. Or, you know, here's a technique to know where the radio dial is. And so in a lot of ways, this was terrifically annoying as a kid, right? Or even as an adult, you know, all of the litanies of menu items read aloud at every meal, and the nuisance of having to deal with disability in a family, which, you know, we try not to talk about because it's very difficult to contend with. But also the way that focused all of our attention, you know, my attention, my mom's attention, my dad's attention, and those around us, for better or worse, on the ordinary things around us. You know, and I have all of these memories of the, that ordinariness, the, you know, the being at a motel and going to get ice down the hall and looking for, you know, helping my dad find the button, the sort of lighter brown button and the darker brown bezel around it. And you know, the way that that kind of attention forces you to think about something like the design of ice machine buttons or the difference in color between them. And it may seem unimportant or, you know, a kind of luxury in some way to have the ability to think about that sort of attention rather than to have to suffer through the experience of living it. But to me, it trained me in some way. It gave me a kind of physical education in paying heed to ordinary objects and ordinary things, which is really the subject of the book and the summary of the idea. You know, if you can take pleasure in your toaster and the motel ice machine, then what could you not take pleasure in?
We're talking about how we can bring play into all areas of our lives to add focus and meaning. We're talking with philosopher and game designer Ian Bogost. He's professor of interactive computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He's the author of the new book, Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games.
And we'd like to hear from you. Have you found games and sports helpful in other areas of your life? Maybe you play sports or board games. You agree that the way in which we approach play can enhance those other areas of our lives. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org.
We'll pick up a conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our conversation about play and how we can bring play into other areas of our lives, especially those that can seem like drudgery.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an ability? Are you able to bring play and fun into the boring stuff, the daily routine? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Ian Bogost stays with us. He's a philosopher, a game designer, and professor of interactive computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology. His latest book is called Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games.
And we'll go right to our callers. We've got Luke on the line in Green Bay. Luke, hi.
Hey there. I was just curious, Ian, having a background in philosophy, when you say the pleasure of limits, it sounds a lot like the old Stoic philosophy, and I was curious if you considered your theory of living your life as if you're playing a series of games fits into that philosophy, sort of like Marcus Aurelius and some of those classics.
Luke, thanks for the call. Ian, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a savvy question. The Stoics do make an appearance in the book, and one of the things that I talk about in the book is this kind of alternative to looking to happiness or mindfulness, these selfish goals as a way of guiding oneself, and instead to see the sort of Stoic defamiliarization of objects around us and our preparation for the world to continue kind of without us, right, as a way of being able not just to tolerate but to find new meaning. There's this very famous Stoic aphorism or story from Epictetus that, you know, when you put your children to bed, you should imagine in this kind of morbid way, well, what if you die tonight? You know, what would I do next? And it seems very strange, but what it points to is this idea of kind of thinking about the full range of possibilities of a relationship or a circumstance and using that as a way of structuring our relationship to it, of responding to that set of possibilities. I certainly think that the anything that pushes our attention outside of us, right, is a useful compass bearing.
And Ian, we got a lot of callers waiting to talk to you, but I just want to follow up really quickly. You equated mindfulness with selfishness just a moment ago, and that's being billed pretty heavily right now as a path toward happiness and ease in our lives. What do you think about that?
Right. I mean, the mindfulness trend to me, you know, has some utility, but where it fails is in helping us deal with the surplus of materials that are in our world, right? You know, when you borrow Eastern philosophy, Buddhism, Zen, and so forth, it feels good to sort of think that we can separate and use mindfulness to kind of stop ourselves and address our feelings and thoughts and then readdress the world. But we live in this you know, hyper-consumerist society. We have all these different choices of ketchups and shampoos at the store and all of the cars on the road. And there's something kind of fundamentally incompatible about the world that we live in or online, you know, all of the stuff on your phone or in your inbox, and the attitude of Eastern mindfulness. So instead, if you flip that on its head, and I have this concept of worldfulness as kind of the opposite of mindfulness, and use that same exercise that Eastern thinking provides, where you stop yourself and then look more closely. But what you look more closely at is not inside yourself, but outside it. What is the world telling me? What is here, and what can I do with it?
Let's go back to our callers. Laurel is on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Laurel, hi.
Hi. I love what your guest has to say, because I, especially what he's just saying now about the surplus of information and things that can seem overwhelming. And I think we can almost think of like a mental closet and just think, I'm going to deal with that someday. And you put things that seem overwhelming in this closet, and it just feels like you're getting buried. And lately, and I'm not sure why, but I've just kind of done what he's saying about taking something and turning it into a game and thinking, I'm just going to take the 5 minutes and master this, instead of thinking, oh, someday I'll learn how to boost a Facebook page, or someday I'll learn how to make creme fraiche. And just doing it in the moment, and it feels so empowering.
Laurel,
so I guess.
Thank you so much. So, Ian, she's taking an infinite realm of possibilities of things she can do, setting some constraints and picking one of them and engaging with that, it sounds like.
Right. And one of the weird things about constraints and limits or rules in games is that, counterintuitively, the more of them that you add, the easier it is to act. You know, if you took something like soccer as an example that everybody knows, you say, okay, you can do what you want on a field, then it's hard to know what to choose. But if you throw a ball in the field, you say, okay, maybe I'll move the ball around. Oh, and you can only use your feet and your torso. Okay. And you've got to get it into a net. You know, then your action is focused. You have a better sense of not just what you can do, but what you are going to choose to do given the constraints that you've adopted. And you can do that with ordinary things too. You know, what is creme fraiche anyway, and what goes into it, and what's the process of making it, what are the techniques and the traditions and so forth. Once you add all those limitations in, you find yourself in a position where you can act. And, you know, the next day you might choose to do something else, but for that moment, in that scenario, you're focused on a specific thing and at one with it, you know, communing with it directly.
Thanks a lot for that call, Laurel. And Ian, as we wrap up, I assume you're practicing the things that you're talking about, that you've sort of integrated them into your own life. How does the shape of your life look or feel different now?
Yeah, I mean, this is a struggle for me, like it is for anyone. Writers, I think, write about what they struggle with, and this has always been a struggle for me. But the opportunities are so endless that I find myself able to stop myself from getting anxious or getting angry or upset. And just asking, okay, well, you know, what's happening here? One example that I can give you is that a little while back, my wife was carrying a gallon of milk up the stairs, and she kind of tripped, and in this freak accident, the jug of milk split, and the milk just poured down the stairs, just cascaded down the down the stairs. And I was actually finishing some writing at the time. I was very stressed out, and you know, here's this thing going on now that we have to clean up. And as ridiculous as it sounds, when I stopped myself, I said, okay, well, you know, this is probably the only time I'm going to see this much milk in my life. Let's just look at what that much milk looks like and how it sounds as this kind of improvised art installation pouring down my stairs. That was delightful. That was delightful enough that it got me out of the mode of anxiety that I was tempted to move into. And then, of course, we cleaned it up and got on with our lives. And I hope that never, ever happens again.
And that's a great image to leave it with. Thanks to Ian Bogost. His new book is Play Anything, The Pleasure of Limits, The Uses of Boredom, and The Secret of Games.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.